And for a couple of minutes here, I wonder if anyone would like to say what you experienced doing this. What happened for you? Please.
It's a question, really.
Sure.
It was an amazingly powerful experience. But what seemed to happen for me was as though I was experiencing something ahead of me. It was as though something was sitting on my lap. Wider than that. I had a back, but no thought of it at all. And it was a very unusual experience.
Wow. Yeah, I've actually heard other people talk about similar things like that. I think, again, in ways that are not understood, people can have very non-normal sensory experiences, including strong sensations in like a in their head or tension. Sometimes it's unpleasant, you know, for some people, you know, when they really go deep. And then others have this sort of sensory experience like you're describing. One of the breakthroughs kind of similar to that. It reminds me, you may know Douglas Harding, an Englishman who wrote a famous book in the 70s called On Having No Head. He had kind of an awakening in the Himalayas, I think in Nepal, where he was walking and he suddenly experienced that he had no head. There was just the world, you know, as a kind of oneness experience. So I don't know. But I'm very glad that, you know, again, some people you probably feel like you're falling asleep or it's frustrating. Whereas for others, you can kind of track these states of mind, which have been traditionally described for mysterious reasons as steps which seem to make sense into stabilizing this neural substrate of consciousness and then filling it increasingly with just one thing. So I think, that's great. I'm glad. Okay, please.
I've had those shudders coming from the base of the spine before and assumed that something was wrong. You know?
Oh, okay, good.
So I've had a lot of these today. And then, and the breath seemed very, very pure. It wasn't continuous awareness of it all the time, but I came back to it, I think, very quite quickly each time. It seemed very pure. And then I got a series of green patches with a purple patch, one after the other. Following through.
Oh.
And then you caught on.
Yeah. How was it for you, by the way, with more of the emotional aspects as well, the contentment and tranquility?
I felt very straight and upright and clean, I think. I wouldn't describe the thing as particularly joyous, but
it sounds fairly tranquil. Yeah, for once. It sounds fairly tranquil, too. You were nodding as well, right?
Well,
on the visual stimuli? Yeah.
Yeah, I was, not that experienced in meditation, but I was experiencing it felt like a vibration, sort of coming.
Yeah.
But yeah, seeing the colour, indigo and colours swirling.
What she was saying was that, consistent with him, she also too felt a certain amount of vibration or pulses. That's often how people describe it. And then there were some color phenomena too, like indigo or purple, you know, deep blue or something, and green. Again, people do talk about these interesting sensory phenomena. Who knows what's going on? I think part of what's happening is when we tip into these more intense and non-normal states and we stay with them, without doing the typical thing of distracting or having some other stimulation come through, new connections start being made. You know, as this neural substrate of the, you know, consciousness starts moving around and stabilizing in new ways, suddenly it grabs circuits over here for color, you know, in the occipital cortex, and suddenly you see purple. Who knows? And, you know, that maybe that means something or maybe it doesn't. I don't know yet, but, you know, people definitely report something like that. I just want to make a quick little point related to that, which is that the attempt in this part of practice, which is just one part of practice, that the attempt is to train the brain, literally, in effect, to train the brain to have a large neural substrate of consciousness that's stable, in which there's great attentional control. You can really control the attention. And So one does not do here a typical Vipassana meditation where you just kind of have choiceless awareness of whatever flows through the field of consciousness. You're deliberately trying to stick attention into and have it fall more and more deeply into one thing, one well-chosen thing. And one of the benefits of that is then when you want to do more standard Vipassana meditation or mindfulness meditation, you now have a better stabilized platform for attention. Because just to relax and observe the stream of consciousness without getting sucked into it, that's really challenging. That's actually harder than it is to really, you know, work the muscles of concentration. So to do Vipassana well, it really helps to be able to stabilize attention. And that goes also to your comment earlier about batting away. I was realizing I should have made that distinction. Classically, it's seen that there are two basic kinds of meditation. I think there are probably a couple others as well. But there's a distinction between focused attention, where that's absorption. That's what we're doing here. That's the Buddhist traditional description of one part of practice. And then there's open awareness, which is, I think, maybe more what you're talking about, more kind of classic Vipassana meditation. Both are great. One's done better than the other. My own open awareness practice really took off after I had learned to steady the mind better. Okay. All right. I want to talk a little bit, if I could, about some of what might be going on in the brain and why we're doing it, and call out a few things that are a little bit off the beaten track that are methods that I myself have come across based on understanding something of the brain. Other people may have come across them in other areas in the world who didn't know anything about the brain. Fine, you know, but at least, you know, to me they make brain sense. One is to give up control of breathing. That's a very interesting one, where you give up breathing. You'd be willing to not breathe until the body breathes on its own. That both is a great anatta practice, surrender of self, if you will, and also it tends to quiet the mind, because you just are giving up in an extremely intimate and survival-focused way, right? Just you're willing, in effect, to not be here by giving up control of the breathing. It's interesting to experiment with giving up conscious control of breathing. Whole body awareness is another major method, and then I'm going to definitely do it when we get into singleness in a moment. I'll call it out now. When you do whole body awareness, instead of attention moving from part to part to part, which you can see is that's the way attention normally moves when you're aware of the body, it's to be aware of the body instead, or just the body of breath, as one whole percept, one whole unified thing. Right? Track that word, unified. That's a way into the unification of awareness that's characteristic of the singleness factor, or in the Pali language, ekagata. Right? Okay. Any more? Thanks. You had a question or comment.
I was just going to say that I believe that the colours are related to chakras opening up, particularly if your consciousness is opening up. The violet often comes along,
okay,
which might be connected to, for instance, with the eighth jhana, which is really opening up, and the green more with the heart.
Oh, okay.
So that would be, I think, a fairly standard explanation for
within that system, right, which could be true. You know, I often think these traditional descriptions, they arose for a reason. And then the interesting thing now with Western science is we start to understand at least the gross material sort of reason, and there may well be a higher spiritual reason. I don't know. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, maybe one more person, and then are you up for another practice? Because we're kind of going there. All right, in the back. Yeah. Well, thank you. I'd say two things about that. The first is that when we spend much of the day without controlling our breath, right? Just going through the day, we're not applying conscious control. Certainly while we're sleeping, we're not consciously controlling the breath. The body breathes naturally without any kind of external control. Very often when we bring attention to it, I find often there is a kind of control that creeps in. And by not paying, by not trying to control the breath, that forces an attention to these subtle executive systems that start controlling, which are very close to selfing. So by not trying to control the breath and then seeing what happens then, that takes you into a more minute and mindful understanding of self-related, I, me, and mine-related activities in general, right? On the other hand, sometimes for different people at different times, a method is not right for them. And, for example, in your case, you're describing that it helps you stay here to have to apply just enough kind of control, if you will, of the breathing. And I think one of the great Dharma stories is Goldilocks and the Three Bears, right? I don't want to bore you or be a bore, but anyway. It's that just right spot, right, where it's not too hot or too cold. There's not too much control or too little control of the breath. Just enough. That's so much the middle way, isn't it? Right? It's not too tall, not too short, not too hard, not too soft. Just right. Right in the middle. Okay. Maybe another person? Or no? Could you track the distinctions? Just even in basic ways. You know, a kind of bodily bliss, and then a happiness, a contentment, and a tranquility. If you couldn't, it's okay. But those four states of mind, I think, are useful to track the distinction between, or among, rather, and be able to, by having a clear sense memory of each one, be able to drop into them, almost like changing the channels. It's almost like music. You know, bliss is like major heavy metal rock and roll, right? And then happiness is more like mellow rock, and contentment is sort of like new age music, and tranquility is like white noise, in a sense. That's what you're doing. You're turning the channels, or the visual, example of that. Okay, yeah.
Well, on that point, because my experience through those stages is actually there's this kind of spontaneous visualization, spontaneous vision. So it went from a kind of sun rising to a kind of deeper, sort of almost plum colour, and then when you came to a you can get equanimity, it would turn into a mill pond, and then with the tranquility, it was pond at night time with the moon. And it was, these were spontaneous.
That's neat.
And that was my experience.
Yeah.
It was a visual experience.
Yeah. He's describing moving through these states in a fairly visual way, right? I've known some people who, when I give visual cues for doing a practice, they don't relate to it. They come at it more in a sensate kind of way, or even almost a sound way. Some people are very sound-based, maybe musicians or very auditory. It's almost like they hear tones or songs or chimes, whatever works for you. You know, the point is, in kind of plain English, we sort of know what each one of these states is. We're moving through it. We're going after it. It also gets to a larger point, which is the Buddha was very inventive. If you really just make a list and count all the different methods and practices, I think it's like several hundred, actually. He was very inventive, and he encouraged people to adapt practice to their own needs. You know, with that just right Goldilocks raft metaphor, the sweet spot that's just right for you, to adapt it and to experiment. To be experimental. Some of the best teachers for me on retreat have told me basically to abandon the script. In other words, I've come into them sometimes in interviews and said, this is what's going on, which is kind of off the program, if you will. And they've said to me, keep going. In other words, sure, go after it. And then they're like, if they knew I wouldn't tell on them, they'd say, I did it too, or something like that. Like, okay. So how about we do a practice now, and then we'll preserve a little time at the end for a talk, and I'll try to end very close to 4:30 today. And I'll happily stick around, too, to chat if you'd like to do that. Okay? So, come into yourself, and we're going to go after singleness. Singleness is a deep state. These are I'm really going for home runs here, all right? So maybe we only get close, but it's okay. But we're going to go after singleness. Here, singleness is a state where everything comes together, the mind is very quiet, there's equanimity or something pretty close to it, and a great way into it is to sense the breath as a whole. So that's where we'll start. So take a big breath and relax. And see if you can find your way back again over the next minute or so to tranquility. Either what you experienced, or you can feel into again a fundamental kind of stillness, peacefulness. Maybe sensing a stillness that's always already present inside you. Abiding as stillness. Aware of the vast open space of awareness, boundless and vast, through which mental contents pass like clouds across the sky, appearing and vanishing again. Tranquility as a vast and boundless open space. Sounds, sights, mental phenomena, experienced as mere modifications, transient, passing modifications of awareness. Awareness itself, always the same, always available, always empty and still. Explore awareness of the breath as a whole, all the various sensations of inhalation or exhalation, experienced as one whole thing. That sense of the whole as one gestalt may appear and then crumble. Explore that process and then regenerate it. The breath experienced as one whole thing, even if only for a second. Moving out to awareness of the body as a whole. All the sensations in each moment as one gestalt, one unified percept. Completely surrendered, simply being a body breathing, nothing else to do, no one to be. A body as a whole, peacefully breathing. Awareness of experience as a whole. Body breathing, hearing, knowing, in each moment, always a whole. Nothing in the mind needs to connect to anything else. Nothing needs to make sense. Steadying absorption into peaceful presence as a whole. Tipping into singleness. May akagata, may singleness arise. stable, quiet, awake presence. Boundaries and barriers falling away within the mind. One whole unified experience. May singleness be present. May singleness arise. Simply being at peace, clinging, falling away. Insight may arise into the mind or the world. Abiding, peaceful, and free. And now, as you like, we'll take a minute or so to move back out of singleness to tranquility and then contentment or happiness. And I'll ring the chimes. Rule one, learn how to ring the bell. So again, see what it's like to allow there to be a momentum of whatever places you've entered. Allow those neural coalitions to keep firing and wiring together while we weave into that verbal thought. Right? Bringing both of them together is very artful. I wanted to make a brief comment and then hear what you experienced, and then we'll move to a wrap today. One thing that one does when one goes from bliss to happiness to contentment to tranquility and then to singleness is one is basically dropping away grasping or aversion, carrots and sticks. And as those fall away, we actually enter more the natural mind, in our actual home base, when we're not moved by appetite for carrots or fear or loathing or anger at sticks. Who are we? You know, what is the mind? What is the brain when it's not disturbed by greed or hatred? It's a pretty nice place. It's a pretty nice neighborhood, right? Home base is a good place. This is home base. You know, this is who we are when we're not disturbed. And it's a different workshop, but there's also a natural love, as you were saying earlier, a natural kindness that emerges when the mind settles and stills into a quieter place. And it makes sense, because when you're in a very tranquil place, you're not triggering all those limbic systems, those emotional systems that drive greed and hatred. All right. Any comments or questions as we move to an end here? Yes.
I find that the distinction between inside and outside seems to disappear.
Aha! The distinction between inside and outside seems to disappear. Yes. Many people report that, and that's actually a part of a traditional instruction in a, for example, a Tibetan meditation that Joseph Goldstein has adapted, where there's that sense of inside and out. self and world. The boundary falls away. In the brain, that probably corresponds to, I always get the two sides mixed up, but it's in the parietal lobes. One side of the parietal lobe establishes that the self-world distinction, which you kind of need to go through the supermarket, right? Or to drive your car. My car is different from your car. That's an important distinction. And I think it's the left side that, based on that distinction between self and world, locates us where in the world we are. And I suspect that, consistent with different accounts and some neurological data, that when people especially get quite deep, these regions of the parietal lobes sort of deactivate effectively. It falls away. And there's a loss of self-world boundaries, and inside and outside, therefore. One reason why Jill Bolte Taylor, who you may have seen her talk, My Stroke of Insight, minimally it's worth watching her talk, or maybe looking at her book. She had a catastrophic stroke, mainly in the left side, and it knocked out the left parietal. So she suddenly had no sense of where she was, and probably related, no sense of separation from the world. One way into that is this method of open, boundless space, or the panoramic view, just simply the bird's eye view. And as I said earlier, that lights up those lateral networks that really help the mind get quieter, in part because there's much less self in these lateral networks, especially in the right side, which is visual spatial side. I've been using that panoramic awareness more. It's also good in therapy with people, you know, because we get less upset when we actually visualize a literal physical distance between us and our issues. There are studies that if you prime people by having them measure distances, and you have them either measure very short distances or very great distances in phase one of an experiment, and then in phase two have them rate whether, you know, disturbing pictures are more or less disturbing. If you've primed them by having them, you know, estimate vast distances first, they evaluate pictures as relatively less disturbing. See? Isn't that interesting? Just that priming. Okay. That's an example of how cognition is very embodied, right? And if you work with the body first, you can then shift the mind, and you can also go in the other direction. Right? Other people, how did you experience? Did you get to some sense, even for just a second or two, of just one breath or just one whole breath or the body as a whole as a single percept, and then maybe a tipping into a sense of just relatively effortless, just spacious, peaceful presence rolling on? Yeah. It seemed very quiet in here. It made me want to go longer, actually. Couldn't. Anybody else? In the back, maybe? Or the left, the right? Yeah, please. Yes.
I slightly dyslexic, which I've been told that your brain just goes pop, 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 pop.
Uh-huh.
And it, the actual cells spill out into other areas of the brain.
Huh.
There was some research in UC. And I just wondered if that would be really brilliant together in a physical way.
Yeah, she said first that it was very helpful to some kind of consolidating or cohering, if you will. And then she brought it up, related to the topic of dyslexia, some theories of, there are multiple theories of the causes of dyslexia. It's an area of research, and I know something about it because I work with kids, too, and do assessment. And this one notion is that, which relates a little bit to ADD, a little bit, if you think about it, a kind of, in effect, a very associative mind, you know, pop, 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 which kind of goes with intelligence, too. I have a friend who's really into dyslexia. She's an expert on it. She talks about the gift of dyslexia, which is a nice way to reframe it as well. And then there was a wondering if maybe through these different practices, one could create more integration or coherence, which then might pay off in a benefit for reading skills, maybe. I've never heard of any kind of research about that, but more and more people are applying. Like, I was at a conference at University of East London, organized by my friend Patricia in the back of the room here, where people were talking about applying, for example, in really novel contexts, some of these deep trainings of mindfulness, for example. Like for autistic people on the Asperger spectrum. So I wouldn't be surprised that there will be some cross-fertilization that's pretty exciting here. And I like your idea. I think it's very interesting to play with. Okay. Anybody else? Maybe one more person, then I'll say something and we'll end. Yeah. Yes.
And I was just wondering whether did you present that so that we would kind of wake up again? Because at the end of it, I did feel like it's opened my eyes.
So the comment observed that in the instructions I gave, almost like think of them stepping stones into a very deep and wonderful pool, kind of a luscious, warm pool that starts to really draw us down, right, and kind of keeps us in the pool. So, you know, bliss, happiness, contentment, tranquility, right? And then singleness, really deep in the pool. The jhanas, way down in the deep end, you know, with our breathing tube. And then the instruction was to come back, at least come back up some steps. I could have done all the steps intuitively, which is what my normal script says to do that I wrote, but I just felt it was okay to just hang out at contentment. You know, then I'd go all the way back and out. It seems you all seem very deep. And for a workshop, I've taught this workshop probably half a dozen times, and it's just felt very deep there. So I kind of tuned into it. But why, your question is really why come back out? And you noted, she noted that it's pleasant. There's a part of us that wants to stay down there. That's a mark of absorption, that it feels almost hard. Like I've had experiences on retreat where it feels hard to get up out of the chair. Haven't you had? Probably quite a few people have had similar kinds of experiences. I did it deliberately because I felt it was improper and irresponsible to just ring the bell when you're deep in singleness, chat for 5 minutes, and then send you out into the London evening traffic. I felt, you know, like trust in God, but tie your camel. So it was kind of a can. I thought contentment seemed like it was okay way station. But it does speak to the desire, again, the natural state. We love these places, isn't it? I mean, compared to singleness, tranquility is a little gross. Compared to tranquility, contentment's a little gross. You know, compared to contentment, happiness is a little gross, and so on. Isn't that interesting? And then again, that's the way, you know, it's described that you go into these marvelous states, and they start to feel a little gross, and you recognize the clinging embedded in them that makes them feel gross, and we drop away the lesser pleasure for the even greater one, the second jhana. And then we do that again for the third jhana and so forth. Okay. Well, I think the larger point here is that what we've tried to do is an illustration. You know, it's an illustration that, you know, there are things we can do surprisingly. Can you imagine? Here, we just did this. Those meditations, each one of those meditations was about 20 minutes long. It wasn't like 45-minute sits, you know, multiple sits. But by doing certain things skillfully with these factors, you know, in the brain, like we're talking about here, and just kind of, again, adapting it to individual needs and messing around with it a bit, one can actually really work inside the black box, you know, pull on some levers, turn up some dials, help the organism move in a direction it wants to go in, you know, and now go there fairly directly. And the idea is to really have an adventurous, investigative attitude. You know, the seven factors of enlightenment, investigation is often considered the most fundamental because that's what drives the rest. Or as Joseph Goldstein says when he looks back on his own life of practice, what really drove his practice was curiosity. So there can be an investigative stance and also an experimental stance, an adventurous stance, and also a stance that says, hey, let's go into the deep end of the pool. Let's follow the path of the Buddha that makes sense. It's now really supported by Western science. And deepen these capacities to steady the mind and then use that heft driven by the sharpness of our vipassana insight to really cut through, you know, the ropes and ties that bind us to suffering. So may that be so for us and all other beings. So thank you really very much. It's tremendous attention. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. And you're welcome.
Thanks, Rick. I guess I don't get often to say this, but my neural substrate feels filled with gratitude. I've read a bit of Rick's stuff before and listened to some audio interviews he'd done, and so I have pretty high expectations of this day. But I must say, it's been really exceeded. Just the combination of the authentic teachings, the experiential practice, reflections on the experiential practice, and the sort of mashups from neuroscience. It's really been a really sort of vibrant.
Great.
And certainly opened up some stuff for me, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sort of firstly for that, Rick, on behalf of everyone here. Rick, just to say something more about the economics of this day, to those of you who are relatively new to London Insight events. Rick mentioned it earlier today, this idea of generosity, or this foundation of generosity which underpins this tradition and the transmission of it as it continues. The sort of costs to which you pay to register very much sort of cover the cost of the venue and some basic expenses for Rick, but otherwise he does not receive any remuneration for his teachings. It's offered very much in a spirit of generosity. And therefore, we invite all of us who feel so inclined to offer some generosity in return financially. There is a box at the back, a light brown box, entitled Dana, D-A-N-A, is the Pali word for generosity, for which this sort of, without which this organisation wouldn't work. We don't actually, in this case, collect dana for the organisation itself. All of that runs through the cost. So all the dana we collect does go directly to it.
But it's also good to contribute to London Insight at some other time. I'm a big believer in dana. I go from center to center saying, support your local centres. You know, the centres are great. On that note,
There is another rather beautifully, colourfully decorated box in the corner. And we're actually collecting for a charity this year, which is the Kapuka Project, which is an HIV AIDS initiative in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, set up by two, Taniso and Kisawa, two well-known teachers in this tradition. And it's a community centre for a very rural area of South Africa, supporting community care and health needs. And so we've been having a really good year supporting that. So if you care to support that further, there is a very colourful box. Other announcements are there is actually another neurology based event next year, and our whole program will be announced in the next 2 to 3 weeks, so please do check back to the website, or if you're on the mailing list, you will receive an email about that with the whole 2010 calendar, which is really again looking very exciting, lots of new style events and the core sort of day-long retreats as well. And the next retreat this year is with Rob Bebea, a very gifted teacher who's a resident teacher at Gaia House. And that's Sunday, December the 6th, in our usual venue of King Alfred School in North London. Chris is signaling me to the back saying, there are only 4 of Rick's books available, so if you'd like to purchase one today before they come out on the 1st of December in the UK, please do so.
May I add also, if you'd like to be on the mailing list, which I keep in confidence, for the Wise Brain Bulletin, I think there's some sort of sheet back there. Okay, great. Great. Keep going, sorry.
And one more announcement is that London Insight is collecting a group of us who would care to go together to the Climate Change March on the 5th of December, which is a Saturday, which is aligned with the Copenhagen summit that weekend as well. So there'll be an email coming out about that as well. We'll speak to Chris Cullen at the back. If you're interested in, if you're already going to that march and would like to go as a group, or would like to go. Apart from that, thank you all very much for coming. It's been a great day. I've been very supportive. The room's been really great. And thanks again to Rick. It's been such an honour to have some of your quality here with us.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Keep going. Thank you. That was very kind. Thank you.
take a couple of calls.
Yeah.
Take some things.